Hello, I'm Shane Grin. This is number 0216, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0216. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Rhea King, who is the author of From Daydream to Dream Job, Making Money Being Creative.
So it's really just getting into that entrepreneurial mindset of starting to think about, look at what you do differently and thinking about, okay, where can I find people who would be interested in what I'm doing? How can I get my message in front of them? Who am I competing with in the marketplace? And it doesn't take people very long once they kind of put on that sort of perspective to very quickly start getting used to seeing things in a whole new way and acting accordingly, and that's when the success comes.
Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back on the show to talk about the long-distance travel of Voyager 1.
A set of new papers was published in the journal Science in early September that confirms officially that the Voyager 1 spacecraft, which is now about 18.7 billion kilometers away from the sun, has officially departed from the solar system, left the realm of the sun's influence, so to speak.
TJ Mercer is a reality TV coach and the author of So You Want to Be on a Reality Show, Inside Tips to Make the Cut.
They're looking for personality. So even if you have not done any TV, if you have a personality, one of my key tips is to be you times 10, because television will suck the energy out of you and make you into a 2D person. When you are turning up your personality and going times 10, you're turning into a 3D person.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, plus, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0216 was Shane Grin, who is a musician and a producer here in Montreal. And I thank you very much, Shane, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, the staff at a Home Depot store in North Charleston, South Carolina, called police after customers reported a man and a woman stepped into a shed that was on display and closed the door behind them. When officers arrived, the couple were still inside. They opened the door and found the woman disheveled and partially clothed, and the man without a shirt and his pants around his ankles. After questioning, the officers determined that they were indeed having sex in the shed. Wonder how long it took them to figure that out. Sean Bowden, age 31, and Emily Craig, age 20, were charged with indecent exposure and disorderly conduct. Indecent exposure? Really? I mean, they did close the door. I mean, the door wasn't open and they weren't exposed until the cops opened it. But I digress. An Oklahoma man was arrested on burglary charges after police matched his DNA to used toilet paper found at the scene of the crime, according to police. Charles Markill Williams, age 20, was charged with burglary in Oklahoma County District Court for allegedly stealing from an area home. Police said the suspect broke into the home, took several items, and used the bathroom before taking off. Unflushed feces and a used piece of toilet paper on the floor were found at the scene. Police matched DNA found in the messy bathroom to Williams. First of all, imagine the joy of the forensics team that had to collect that evidence. And second, serves the idiot right for getting caught. I mean, hey, what, you can't flush? Seriously. Simple hygiene. Simple hygiene here. I bet he didn't wash his hands after either. Moving right along, a 36-year-old patient is suing California's Torrance Memorial Medical Center, claiming that anesthesiologist Patrick Yang decorated her face with stickers while she was unconscious, and that an aide took photos for laughs, later allegedly uploading them onto Facebook. Dr. Yang and the aide were later disciplined but remained in good standing. Some hospitals, and by the way, Torrance Medical or Memorial is not one of them, prohibit cell phones in operating rooms at all times. Why a hospital would allow cell phones into operating rooms is beyond me, but that's another story for another day. Well, evidently, apparently, surgery, judging by this story, is kind of boring. Must think of things to do to pass the time. Yes. Two groups were quarreling over loud music at a campground in Chino, California, when DJ Barber, a member of one of the groups, and Matthew Rincon with the other drew guns, brandished them, and shot multiple rounds into the air, according to Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department spokesperson Steve Whitmore. But what Rincon, age 24, apparently didn't know was that Barber was an L.A. County Sheriff's deputy. And what Barber, who was 44, apparently didn't know was that Rincon was an L.A. County Sheriff's deputy as well. Yes. Chino police arrested both deputies, and Whitmore notes that they have been relieved of duty, but they are still getting paid. "This is gross negligence," said Whitmore. Well, Whitmore, if it's such gross negligence, then sober up and stop paying them. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the incident started when Quashina Jouette, age 33, pulled into a gas station in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, behind Randa St. Cyr. Jouette confronted St. Cyr, who she says was taking up too much space, but St. Cyr refused to move until she finished pumping gas. That's when Jouette took matters into her own hands, or rather, her daughter's hands. She allegedly ordered her 12-year-old daughter to punch St. Cyr in the face. According to police, St. Cyr was unable to defend herself because she was recovering from shoulder surgery. The police report says that after her daughter attacked St. Cyr, Jouette reached into St. Cyr's car and grabbed her phone and then took off. Police were able to track her by using the phone's GPS. Oh, gosh. And Jouette was arrested and charged with burglary, contributing to the delinquency or dependency of a child, resisting arrest without violence, dealing in stolen property, false ownership of a pawned item, and grand theft. Well, at least she didn't teach her daughter to steal. She only taught her to hit. You know, I really wanted to make Jouette the idiot of the day, but I didn't. That comes later in the program. But right now, let's just get to our first guest on the Stuff File, shall we? With the bleak job market showing no signs of improving anytime soon, many who are unemployed or underemployed are looking outside the corporate world for creative ways to make extra cash. Are there really opportunities to earn money doing something you truly enjoy? Marketing expert Rhea King is the author of From Daydream to Dream Job, Making Money Being Creative. She joins us on the line right now from just outside Philadelphia to offer up some answers. Hi, Rhea.
Hi, very nice to be with you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So it's always best, I feel, and I've been lucky to do something I've always wanted to do and do it since something I've wanted to do since I was seven. But the best place to start is to work with something that you are passionate about. But having said that, in this day and time, is it easier to, or is it a good idea to look back at that idea and maybe pursue it once and for all?
I work with people who do this all the time, and it's so exciting to see people reconnect with the things that make them passionate. And what I find is when, you know, having the passion and the talent for something, you're already halfway there. So the only other piece people tend to need is just that marketing piece to know how to promote themselves to the right audience. And they're often running. They often surprise themselves with how successful they can be.
The idea of self-promotion right there is something that, you know, from the days of the industrialized world which up until the, you know, just before the major computer age was not something the average person ever had to think about. So is this a whole new mindset for the general population about how they have to think about what they can do and how they can offer it to others?
It certainly is. It's something that people don't tend to have to think about in, you know, having a 9-to-5 type job. So it's really just getting into that entrepreneurial mindset of starting to think about, look at what you do differently and thinking about, okay, where can I find people who would be interested in what I'm doing? How can I get my message in front of them? Who am I competing with in the marketplace? And it doesn't take people very long once they kind of put on that, you know, sort of perspective to very quickly start getting used to seeing things in a whole new way and acting accordingly, and that's when the success comes.
Okay, so there are basically two groups of people, those who are currently in jobs, maybe jobs that they find somewhat unfulfilling and they want to do something that is more within the realm of passion, and there are those who, either because of money restraints or because of a recent layoff, are forced into doing something new. Let's talk about the first group first. Somebody who already has a job, but they're thinking, maybe there's something else out there for me. What's the first step they should make?
The first step, and this person's in a good situation already having a job, so that's a nice secure place to start. So as they're starting to consider their options, I always recommend, as they're thinking about the things that they're really passionate about that they would like to consider doing, starting to look out into the marketplace, go online, see who else is doing something like this, looking into these areas that interest you, and seeing who's doing business there, what are they selling, you know, services, products. If you see a lot of people making money doing what you're looking to do, that's actually a really good sign because it means it's a strong market and there are lots of buyers to support it. If you don't see a lot of people, you may just want to tread a little carefully. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad market. Depending on what you sell and your price points, you actually may not need a whole lot of buyers. But yeah, really getting out there first off and seeing what's out there, what's selling.
And what about people in the second group, the more dire situation where maybe they don't have a full-time job or a part-time job or any kind of income coming in, but they're thinking, I don't just want to find a job. I want to find a job that is a dream job.
Mm-hmm. That group, of course, you know, in their unfortunate circumstance, are going to have more time to do this, but at least, you know, kind of the silver lining is they'll have more time to do this to make things happen more quickly. The other good piece of news is that it's become easier than ever. I mean, this is we live in good times for entrepreneurs. It's easier than ever to put out a really professional-looking storefront, either for free or very little money. There are loads of free websites. That would be a great first step. Get that website up right away if you don't have one. You know, put out your billboard on the information superhighway so people can find you, and that would be a great first step. And then start working on some of the other, you know, promotional aspects of what you're looking to do.
Some people are queen bees and some people are just drones. Is everyone is everyone capable of being an entrepreneur? Should everyone try if they want to be an entrepreneur?
That is an excellent question. It's certainly not for everyone. I think everyone has the capacity to do it to different degrees. But it's very much like exercise. The more you put into it, the more you'll get out of it. And, you know, running your own business is very much like that. And I've met plenty of people who are perfectly happy to just kind of tinker with something part-time and that makes them happy. And what I like about all of this is there isn't necessarily one, you know, a firm right and wrong for everybody. It's what's right for you is right. And I think that's nice.
Everybody knows somebody who has who had at some point a sideline job, even if they had a full-time job. I mean, my sister, for over 40 years, worked at various full-time jobs and had a full career. She was also an Avon lady. So, you know, there's always that group. Are we seeing more and more of that? In other words, is what my sister used to do many years ago becoming a little bit more the norm? Is everybody thinking of more than just one thing, even at the same time?
I know, you know, in my experience working with clients, I'm definitely seeing more and more of that. It really does seem to be the norm. And sometimes partly for financial reasons, and also I see more and more people really just having the sense of not wanting to put all their eggs in one basket. And so that's a big driver as well, I'm finding.
Now, the book, which is From Daydream to Dream Job, Making Money, Being Creative. When you first came up with the idea of writing this book, who were you looking at your prime target audience of being?
I was really targeting it toward musicians, artists, crafters, anyone creative who's been doing something as a hobby that they love and would love to make money at it, but just they don't know how. And so it was really, that was who I was writing that specifically for.
And do you find that there is a propensity for one gender over another to be more entrepreneurial, or does it make no difference whatsoever? Or are they just different types of entrepreneurs?
I can't really say I've noticed one gender over another. I get a really even mix of people, so it just seems to be more someone's personality type that more than anything that I see.
What's the biggest point you want to get across to your audience for the book From Daydream to Dream Job?
The biggest thing I would want people to know is that you can do it. I want people to be empowered, and I really tried to put this book together to take business concepts, but put them out there in a very friendly way and with specific examples that creative entrepreneurs can use, and just to empower them and let them know that they really can do it. I see it every day. So people know more than they think they know, and can really often surprise themselves with just how successful they can be.
What is the biggest entrepreneurial drawback as far as you're concerned? Is it either lack of entrepreneurial skills or fear of making the leap?
Wow, that's an excellent question. Probably a little of both. Probably about an equal measure, no less. It's a scary thing, and I can certainly appreciate that. And people, at the same time have this drive. They know they want to do this, but when they don't know how, that seems to be a big sticking point that stops a lot of people. But that's an easy obstacle to overcome. If just not knowing how to do something is your only obstacle, the good news is, wow, there's so much information out there. That's an easy one to overcome. So I see both.
So how do you get over the fear?
I would say, making sure that you have a really solid plan, being judicious. I emphasize that over and over in the book, to be judicious, look before you leap. Make sure if you're going to put out an expenditure on something, that it's well researched, you really know what you're walking into, not doing anything on a whim. I think that those kinds of things take a lot of fear out of it, and also knowing that you're using proven strategies that you've seen work for other people, you see them out there as really solid things that work well for entrepreneurs. That helps as well.
The book is called From Daydream to Dream Job, Making Money, Being Creative. It's written by Rhea King. And Rhea, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. I know people can go to your website. What would they find when they go there?
On my website, which is makemoneybeingcreative.com, they will find lots of free information covering different angles that creative entrepreneurs are looking to learn about. So loads of free information there. Stop on by and see what you can find.
Thank you very much, Rhea, for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Rhea King, author of From Daydream to Dream Job, Making Money Being Creative. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0216, and you'll find links to Rhea's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well,
I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, about Voyager 1. Plus, we'll meet a reality TV coach and author of a book that tells you how you can be on reality TV. And, of course, we do have indeed an idiot of the day. And, lots more Stuff File news on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, including Stuff File news right here, right now, which deals in some shape or form with school and education. And also the problem that I like to refer to as the nanny state, when zero tolerance goes bananas. 12-year-old Joseph Lysikatos had a keychain in his backpack at Alan Sean Feinstein Middle School in Coventry, Rhode Island, but it fell out. Another student grabbed it and was showing it to other students when a teacher saw it and confiscated it because it was in the shape of a gun. The 1.5-inch fob, I repeat, 1.5-inch fob earned Joseph, a 7th grader, a 3-day suspension based on the school's zero-tolerance weapons policy. This boy was the one waving it or showing it to other kids, not Joseph, his mother complained. So why weren't both of them reprimanded? Neither the principal nor the school superintendent, however, will return her calls. Maybe they'll return a lawyer's calls. I mean, this is yet another ignorant example of zero tolerance gone mad. And well, you think this madness would end with that story, but no, wait, here's another one. GB, we could only use his initials because he's only 7, GB is a 2nd grader at Hershey Elementary School in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania. He got a novelty pen from a carnival that, when the button is pressed on the end, it gives the user a mild shock. Now, the boy took the pen out on the school bus, and the driver confiscated it. End of story, right? Not on your life. A sharpened pencil is probably a more dangerous item than this pen was, according to the boy's lawyer, Aaron Martin. Wait a minute. A 7-year-old with a lawyer? Yeah, he has to, because school officials suspended the boy for 4 days and noted in his permanent file that he is a weapons offender. In response, Martin has filed a federal lawsuit against school officials on behalf of the child, and the suit alleges that the district's zero-tolerance weapons policy is unconstitutional and notes that the school's actions means that the boy has been relegated to the same category as violent criminals who bring knives, guns, and explosives onto school property for the purpose of assault, murder, and even terrorism. The boy's lawsuit demands his record be cleared. Oh, to put it another way, the 7-year-old has apparently more wisdom than the school officials. But we're not done. We're not done. Okay, here, this is another zero-tolerance nanny state story that is just so bizarre. A police officer in Mesa, Arizona, has been asked not to drop off his daughter at school while wearing his uniform. Apparently, the sight of a cop with a gun is just too scary for some parents. And the school principal actually called that officer to ask him not to wear his uniform on campus ever again. The issue was that other parents were concerned about the fact that he had a gun. Well, you know, he is a cop. Anyway, the officer who works for the Coolidge Police Department is a parent of a kid that goes to Entz Elementary School in Mesa. The request made by school officials to not wear his uniform and gun on campus shocked and upset a lot of people. Shortly after, the officer posted this comment on his own Facebook page. "Nothing like your kid's school calling and asking if you could not come to pick up my daughter in uniform because parents were concerned when their kids came home telling them that a man at the school was there with a gun. Are you freaking kidding me?" Mesa Unified School District officials say they didn't realize they had upset or offended the officer by asking him not to wear his uniform here on campus. Meanwhile, school officials are now saying that they want to turn the incident into a teachable moment. They invited the officer to a special assembly to talk about what police officers do for the community. I believe that the teachable moment here is that we now know and that everyone has learned that the principal is a moron. That's the teachable moment here. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, still with school, still with not so bright folks, but at least it's not a zero tolerance story. Thank heavens for small mercies. The yearbook at Moorhead High School in Moorhead, Minnesota is back at the printer. The problem, the only problem, is it says Moorhead, M-O-O-R-E-H-E-A-D, High School on the cover. Two classes of students worked on it, and no one noticed the errant E because Moorhead is spelled M-O-O-R-H-E-A-D. By the way, as I said, two students didn't know it. They were working on this project. Neither did the teacher who served as yearbook advisor. They proofed the book and the cover, and they missed it, said the district spokeswoman. I just think it is really weird that they misspelled the town that they live in. Yes. Does that give you a clue about the quality of education in Moorhead? What they need is not Moorhead, but more brain. Wow. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Science writer Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back on the program to talk about space and science and to give us some news of what's going on beyond our atmosphere. And this time it's really beyond our atmosphere. He joins us via Skype-to-Sky communications from right here in Montreal. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Peter.
Nice to have you on the program with us once again. One of the things, actually the only thing I want to talk about this time, is the story of Voyager 1, which for those Star Trek fans, we all know what happens there. But besides that, Voyager 1 has left our solar system, supposedly.
Yeah, that's right. Left the building.
Left the building. But I keep hearing conflicting stories about whether it has or whether it hasn't and what the technical or correct term is. So what's the story?
Right. So scientists have really been perplexed at this idea of when does this spacecraft, this robotic emissary that we sent on this really fantastic voyage back in 1977 when it lifted off, went through this visiting the outer planets, starting from Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and these twin spacecrafts going on their own ways are continuing their voyage out into the stars. But what has been has caused confusion among scientists is really exactly where is the edge of the solar system. And a set of new papers was published in the journal Science in early September that confirms officially that the Voyager 1 spacecraft, which is now about 18.7 billion kilometers away from the sun, has officially departed from the solar system, left the realm of the sun's influence, so to speak.
Okay. So, first of all, let's go back in time a little bit, because we've talked about this in the past with such things as the Mars rover. We know what the Mars rover's life expectancy was when they first went up to the red planet, and they have surpassed that. What was Voyager's original mission, and has it surpassed that?
Well, definitely. I mean, the original mission was really to investigate the outer solar system. Now, there were twin spacecrafts launched within just a couple of weeks of each other in 1977, and the Voyager 2 actually went from Jupiter, Saturn, then Uranus in 1986, and Neptune in 1989, and then left the planet, the plane of the solar system, while Voyager 1 just went through looking at Jupiter and Saturn, the two largest planets in the solar system, and then was sent on a different trajectory from its twin. And since then, it's a lot of the instruments have died on board, so there's no camera system that's functioning, and a lot of the other instrument detectors are not functioning anymore. But there's just a handful of very small little detectors of electrical energy, of particle detections of particles, electrical particles that are flying through space that it can detect. And scientists, there's this small core group of scientists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, that are still with the mission. Now it's called the Voyager Interstellar Mission. And they're basically trying to understand where the edge of the solar system is. What does it look like? And what it turns out is that there is a bubble that of influence that surrounds the sun, sort of a bubble like of a barrier that protects the sun. This barrier is called the heliosheath. And this barrier, we think, is where the Voyager's one spacecraft has now basically punctured through and has entered into the interstellar realm, which means that it's beyond the influence of the sun. So the sun's energy doesn't penetrate beyond this point. So there's more energy coming from other stars where Voyager 1 now is floating through space. There's the particles that it's detecting are not from the sun as much as it is from other stars that are in the Milky Way galaxy.
Wow. Now, where is Voyager 2?
Yes, well, Voyager 2, that's also still kicking around, and that's sitting about 15.4 billion kilometers away on its own journey. And Voyager 2, like I said, explored Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, but it's heading in a different trajectory than Voyager 1, and according to the detectors on board, it hasn't quite reached the same hasn't punctured through that bubble barrier, the heliosheath, yet. So we're still waiting to hear from Voyager 2 on where exactly that's going to be.
And are the problems, because as you say, some of the things on Voyager 1 aren't working as they initially were planned oh so many years ago because they've just gone beyond their lifespan. Can the same thing be said for Voyager 2, or is one working better than the other?
Both are pretty much, they're exact twins, and they were designed the same way, and their lifespan is really pretty much the same in terms of the different detectors on board. But what's very interesting is that what's giving the power is this plutonium battery. And that's really the major determining factor of the lifetime of the spacecrafts. So right now, according to the Voyager scientists, if they look at long-term what this plutonium battery, basically it's a plutonium capsule that's embedded inside one of the wings of Voyager. And in there, it's breaking down. As it's breaking down, it produces heat, which is converted into electricity. And they think that the final little gasp of energy from the plutonium battery will be around the year 2025 for both spacecrafts. So this is really, you know, there is a limited lifetime, and they're very excited on that, the fact that Voyager 1 has already penetrated this outer barrier of the solar empire, and we think that Voyager 2 will reach the edge of the solar system maybe in the matter of before the end of the decade, I think, before the next 5 to 8 years.
And since it is degrading as it gets older, is it traveling any slower? First of all, how fast is it going?
Yeah, they're clocking in around 60 to 70,000 kilometers per hour. So the speeds that they're, because there's no pull of gravity from any nearby object, the velocity is pretty much is the same all the time. And most of that velocity for both spacecrafts were attained through what are called slingshot effects, that they, as they went by the large outer planets. So Jupiter and Saturn gave the swing bys that both spacecrafts did with these giant planets, just gave it that extra oomph, the extra speed to leave the solar system. And that those speeds will be maintained for basically eons. In fact, if we look ahead into the far distant future, Voyager 1, we already know that it will probably continue floating around for tens of thousands of years. And we've calculated the closest it will come to a star is 1.7 light years, a nearby star. That's equal to about 16 trillion kilometers. That's the closest it'll get to another star system. And that won't happen for another 40,000 years from now. Wow. So it's a pretty lonely little traveler.
Now, they aren't named Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, but were they launched in that order?
Actually, I don't know. Actually, I'm not sure.
I know that.
I don't remember which one left first.
I know Voyager 1 left Earth on September 5th, 1977, and I believe Voyager 2 was launched a few weeks earlier. and I was trying to figure out why would two go up before one?
Well, the difference in terms of the timing of how they were leaving has to do with the trajectory that the scientists wanted them to follow. So Voyager 2's mission was to go through four different planets. That was the hope. Of course, that all depended on if it would survive its encounter with Jupiter and Saturn, which Voyager 2 did, in fact, do that. And so they sent them on. So Voyager 2 basically went by Jupiter in 1979, 1980. And then 1982, it visited Saturn. And then 1986, it went by Uranus, and 89, Neptune. And so Voyager 1 was launched on a different time period because it was just supposed to go through Jupiter and Saturn. So only two. So there was a difference in the trajectory that both spacecrafts were going to take. So the timing of launch was very critical for both because of that.
Okay, so bottom line, we know how far they've gone. We know, as you described, how far they're going. What's the biggest thing we've learned from Voyager 1 and 2?
My goodness, that's you know, that the twin spacecrafts, you know, it's really mean. They were more than 35 years, you know, since they were launched. Each of them are much more further away now than, you know, the distant dwarf planet Pluto. It's amazing to think that you know, we've reconnoitered the entire system of planets, all our family of planets, with these two spacecrafts. I mean, they gave us the first views and the only views that we've had, for instance, of the two outermost gas giants, Uranus and Neptune. And we haven't seen anything of them since then, any close-up. I mean, Hubble Space Telescope gives us very fuzzy views. We don't really can't see very much, even with the strongest of telescopes that we build here. It really took us to go there. And, you know, it's kind of sad to think we haven't gone back since then to these planets. There are, you know, on the drawing board, some plans to send spacecrafts to the outer planets, but nothing like the missions that, like, there's only the first time that you go to actually explore an uncharted territory. Mm. And Voyager was able to map out the moons of Jupiter, the moons of Saturn, like we've never seen them before, and see these places not as little pinpricks of light through a telescope here on Earth, but actual worlds. They were transformed from points of light to actual worlds. So we can thank the Voyager spacecrafts for really, you know, totally changing our understanding of our local neighborhood here in the Milky Way we call the solar system.
Well, it looks like it's time to watch the first Star Trek movie again. Andrew, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us once again.
My pleasure.
Andrew Fisakis, the Night Sky Guy. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. And, of course, you'll find the link on my website at thestufffile.com. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. With the recent federal government shutdown, it often seems like politicians can't agree on anything anymore. But I'd like to tell you about a time when two former leaders in Congress who were on total opposite ends of the political spectrum got together to support an issue that usually pits their parties against each other. Several years ago, the liberal former U.S. Senator George McGovern and the conservative former Congressman Jack Kemp made a special TV ad. It began with the two men acknowledging that they almost never agreed on political issues. But then, McGovern, once considered the most liberal politician in America, looked into the camera and said that they did agree on at least one thing: the dangers of lawsuit abuse. You see, after Senator McGovern retired from politics, he bought a small country inn. Unfortunately, frivolous lawsuits eventually led him to close it down. Let's be fair, the more people learn about the harm done by lawsuit abuse, the more they agree that it hurts everyone. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about being on reality TV. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day, but right now, a few more Stuff File news stories for you. On a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, The Smarter Way. to listen to radio. After allegedly stealing a pickup truck in Bellingham, Washington, Wesley French, age 22, Richard Genn, age 22, and Gregory Carson, age 24, eluded police for a day. Then they apparently ditched the truck, and a patrol car spotted the three men in a green car. After a high-speed chase, the men escaped, but were found in a parking lot the next morning in the same car, painted black, but with the same license plates. The suspects were wearing the same clothes, and two of them had black spray paint on their hands. French was arrested on suspicion of felony, eluding, and also on warrants of robbery and a prior burglary. Genn and Carson were initially released, then later arrested on first-degree robbery charges. Now, you know, it could have been worse. They could have been caught red-handed if they had painted a car a different color. I mean, change cars, then change the color of their car, but never think to change plates, change clothes, or wash their hands. They're just simply unhygienically dumb. That's what they are. And finally, before we get to our next guest, here's another story. According to his road manager, pioneer 1970s musician Sly Stone of Sly and the Family Stone fame has a lot of real interesting ideas, including one trying to hire ninja chicks and clowns for his security entourage. Yeah. Stone's latest brainstorm, the aptly named Stone, I may add, by the way, reported, according to the London newspaper The Guardian in August, form a musical group of albinos, which Stone says could neutralize all the racial problems that plague society. Here's a quote. "To me, albinos are the most legitimate minority group of all." Yeah, right. Well, you know, Sly is 70 years old now and has led a hard life of drugs, rock and roll, and debauchery, so he really must be on his last brain cell right about now. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here on the Stuff File program for this week, shall we? Snooki, NeNe Leakes, Omarosa, and even Honey Boo Boo are household names because of their reality TV stardom. But reality TV also includes your favorite HGTV shows that can land you a free home makeover. It's all about the casting. Best-selling author and reality TV coach TJ Mercer helps hopefuls navigate the convoluted process of landing on their favorite show or crafting their own. She joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, TJ.
Hey, Peter. I am so excited about this. I can't tell you. Like, you are in Canada. It's like, okay, this TJ Madness thing is happening. It's starting to go global now. I'm so excited. This is exciting for me.
There you go. Well, one of the things I wanted to know, since you are somebody who works with these people and coaching them to be on reality shows, is it getting more difficult? And the reason why I say that is, you know, with more and more shows out there, people get an idea of how they're supposed to behave or how they shouldn't behave. And does that make it difficult to weed out real attraction seekers who might not be great for TV?
Okay, I'll put it to you like this. There are hundreds of networks that have 24 hours of programming a day. Now multiply that times 7 days a week. So I always tell people, if you want to get on a reality show, it's possible. Now, you may not get on one of the bigger ones like The Biggest Loser and Amazing Race and America's Got Talent, but certainly, you know, there. I was watching in the middle of the night the other day, I was watching a network that I'd never heard of, and I saw the first female winner of Biggest Loser has her own reality show now. So there's certainly opportunities that, you know, can land you on a show. It just may not be, you know, the bigger one. But then also Snooki started out on a smaller reality show before she got Jersey Shore fame. So it's possible.
Okay, so you just mentioned two examples of people who had prior reality TV show experience, albeit on a smaller scale. What about people who have no experience of being on a reality TV show, but this is something they want to do? How do they go about, you know, reaching that pinnacle, which, of course, I'm sure includes getting your book?
Yes, absolutely. Getting my book is actually a great first step. Okay, I'm sorry. That just really cracked me up. But, yeah, in the book, there's over 100 tips but and I walk you through from start to finish of how to do it. Now, there's several genres of reality shows. So the first thing is to decide which type of show do you want to be on. For instance, do you want to be on a docu-soap, let's say like the Kardashians or the Housewives franchises, or do you want to go into competition? And then if you want to go into competition, is it a talent-based competition or is it an adventure competition? So is it a Survivor or is it an Amazing Race or is it a America's Got Talent or American Idol? Or if you just wanted a new bedroom or a new kitchen, like on a HGTV show, I Hate My Kitchen, you have to decide where do you want to land and then go from there. Because each, regardless, though, they're looking for personality. So even if you have not done any TV, if you have a personality, one of my key tips is to be you times 10. Because television will suck the energy out of you and make you into a 2D person. When you are turning up your personality and going times 10, you're turning into a 3D person. Does that make sense?
That makes absolute sense. But the other thing too that's very interesting is, and as I said in the introduction, and you just alluded to, is the fact that a lot of people don't necessarily think that there's casting involved in shows like the HGTV shows where somebody's getting a home makeover. But they are also looking for personalities even in those situations, aren't they?
Peter, can I tell you a secret? Can I tell you a secret?
Absolutely.
Game shows involve casting. Price is Right involves casting. The Million Second Quiz that just aired involves casting. It all revolves around the casting. And so you have to have a personality. You have to bring it just depending on the show. And here's another secret. Can I tell you another secret?
Sure, go ahead.
Casting directors go from show to show to show. So if you submit your video audition, make sure you knock that thing out the park the first time. Why? I have applied a coaching client that actually auditioned for The Biggest Loser. She didn't land on The Biggest Loser, but a year, 2 years later, she gets a call from Extreme Makeover. Why? Because The Biggest Loser casting director ended up going to the Extreme Makeover weight loss edition, and she remembered her. Why? Because her personality, her story, her persona was so big. It may not have been a fit for the particular ensemble cast that Biggest Loser was doing that season, but she saw her as a fit for Extreme Makeover weight loss edition.
Okay, so again, I mentioned your book earlier, which is So You Want to Be on a Reality Show, Insider Tips to Make the Cut. You give ideas as to how people can indeed make that cut. Let's look at the other side of the coin. What's the one thing or a couple of things that people should never do when they're trying to get onto a reality show, besides perhaps not buying your book?
Okay. I'm going to give you 5 juicy ones, and then actually your listeners can go to iSeeMeOnTV.com and get 10. So the first 5 I'm going to give you of the 5 things that casting directors hate. Number 1, do not sit at your webcam and just talk to the camera. We need to move it around. We need you to show us your story, not tell us your story. Number 2, do not hide your quirks, your idiosyncrasies, your challenges, your disabilities. In fact, accentuate them because it may be the one thing that keeps you in the mind of the casting director. Number 3, do not use excessive profanity. We all know that, profanity sometimes is in just the general nature of how a person talks, but I need you to really be judicious about how often you drop the F-bombs. Number 4, do not show up to an audition and whine about the weight. They're not going to give you more time because you've driven for 2 days to get there. Do not whine. They don't want to hear it. They're not going to give you more time. And number 5, do not be a pest. That old adage, don't call us, we'll call you, is in full effect because nothing will get you blacklisted faster than being a pest to the producers.
Wow, this is good tips indeed. Now, is what you do as a reality TV coach and what other people do as casting coaches or casting agents, is it changing with each and every season of reality shows? And I'll give you an example. We've seen the blowback recently from what has happened with some of the contestants on the latest edition of Big Brother. Going forward, does that change how casting directors work and also casting coaches or reality TV coaches like yourself?
I always try to warn my client that you're going to be you, and it's going to come out. You may think you're going in and being conservative, but the thing is, after 3 days of cameras in your face 24/7, those cameras just kind of disappear in your head because you've just gotten used to them. And so what happens is the real you, the real thoughts come out, because no one can maintain that kind of persona 24/7. They just can't if it's not authentic you. So if you have these views in your heart, or these are your polarizing views, understand that may come out. Now, the other side of the coin, it makes great TV. If you are so comfortable with that, you know, own it. You know, if you are racist, own it. It's going to make some great TV. Now, I may not want to deal with you because I don't know if you can tell, I am a black woman. But at the same time, I know it makes great TV. But like with the Big Brother, these women lost their jobs and didn't even know it while they were in the house.
Yeah, my heart bleeds for them.
Yeah, mine too. You don't hear that sarcasm in my voice, do you? No, I really meant that.
Do you think reality TV, and you know, there are people out there who loathe reality TV, so I have to ask this question. Do you think reality TV is here to stay, and can it grow even more than it is right now?
Baby, is it here to stay? They didn't even think it was going to last this long. Absolutely, it's here to stay. And here is my response to every time someone brings that up, the fact that, you know, they loathe reality TV. And the truth of the matter is, when they tell me they loathe reality TV, I then point them to, well, you know, do you watch HGTV? Yeah, I love HGTV. I would love to be on Love It or List It. And I say to them, well, you do understand that that's a reality show. But the bottom line, Peter, is the numbers don't lie. People are watching these shows because the minute the ratings falter, it's canceled. So at the end of the day, all of these notorious reality shows that are, you know, in the news all the time, and these people that we love to hate, you know, I'll say, is the fact that people are watching this. They're watching it, which is why it's on season after season. So as much as we would love to say that it's going to hell in a handbasket and reality TV is this horrible, horrible genre, I have to say, I've got to point you back to the numbers. People are watching it.
You mentioned even game shows have casting directors. What about judge shows?
Judge shows, you go through a screening process. I can't really say, you know, thank you for giving me that idea, because I do have a friend that's on divorce court, and maybe I'll talk to her about the process. I'm not really sure how serious the casting is for, you know, those kind of judge shows. But I would imagine that, again, it's designed to make great TV, because the bottom line is people are not going to watch boring TV. We're not. We, as much as we love to say it, the fact of the matter is we're not. And so I would imagine, based on just my expertise of what I know about the industry, I would imagine that absolutely it's going through a casting process, because you do want to get those engaging characters who will get up there and, you know, say some off-the-chain remarks that will have the Twitter feed blowing up.
The road to getting on reality TV goes through the pages of So You Want to Be on a Reality Show, Insider Tips to Make the Cut. You could also check out TJ's website, rather, which is SoYouWantToBeOnARealityShow.com. TJ, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Let's make it simple. It's actually, the website is www.ICMeOnTV.com, and that's where they can get 10 quick tips to increase their odds.
ICMeOnTV.com. Simple enough. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My pleasure.
Reality TV coach TJ Mercer. Her book is called So You Want to Be on a Reality Show, Insider Tips to Make the Cut. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0216, and you'll find links to both TJ's website and links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A British man admitted in court Thursday he called in a bomb threat to a Liverpool hall after he forgot to book the venue for his wedding. On April 24th, the day of the wedding, Neil McArdle, age 36, panicked and called St. George's Hall, saying the bomb would go off in 45 minutes. McArdle later claimed he tried to call back to explain there was no bomb, but because the building had been evacuated, no one was there. He realized that he hadn't filled in a form, but he didn't have the heart to tell his bride or her family. The whole wedding party turned up to this bomb scare and then found out that there was no actual booking. So, I gotta ask, why would someone think that calling in a bomb scare would get them out of their own self-created snafu of not booking a wedding hall? Well, I can think of two reasons. One, that perhaps they have taken too many bad I Love Lucy schemes to heart, and two, they're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0216. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0216. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.